name. And for more information, please go to the Blackbird Chico Facebook page or check out the event page at Non-Human Radio. And also coming up on April 21st is Pancakes for Peace. On Easter Sunday, April 21st, the Chico Peace and Justice Center will be hosting its 38th annual Pancakes for Peace fundraiser from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., featuring vegan options for pancakes, gluten-free options, topped with real maple syrup. That for more information, go to chicopeace.org. And we have the April 27th, the Chico Vegan Potluck is being held on Saturday, April 27th at 6 p.m. at the Chico Public Library on Sherman Avenue. As always, plant-based Chico will be there. They'll have their special table for Whole Foods plant-based goodies. You can find potluck details and the schedule for the whole year at chicovegan.com. And one last event, on Monday, April 29th, 2019, from 4 to 5 p.m., Dr. Robert Jones, a philosophy professor at Chico State and also a programmer here at KZFR, will be giving a talk on the personhood of chimpanzees. In February 2018, a group of philosophers submitted an amicus brief to the New York court on behalf of legal personhood for two chimpanzees, Kiko and Tommy, and he will be talking about the process of that brief. All right, that's it for the calendar. If you have an event to share, send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com. I am going to have to forego the quote this week because we have run out of time. This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, its underwriters, or its staff.
We do, however, reflect the opinions of our fellow non-human earthlings who'd rather not be killed and eaten, farmed, hunted, raced upon, experimented upon, and otherwise abused.
All right. Our theme music is Ready to Fall by Vegan Activist Rockers Rise Against. Please stay tuned for KZFR's weekly public affairs program, The Real Issue, coming up next from 6 to 7 p.m.
This is Danny Toms and Jeannie Trezino signing off. Until next week, be different, be better, be kind.
And go vegan.
And this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
I was running.
revolution starts right now. You're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. This is Sue Hildebrand, and the Real Issue is a public affairs talk show. We're here every Wednesday night from 6 until 7 p.m. We can also be heard live through the internet at kzfr.org. You can also listen to the archives right from our website. First of all, I want to thank everybody that contributed during the spring 2019 pledge drive. We did really well. We did really well. And it is so deeply appreciated. Every time somebody calls up, it really just shows how supportive this radio station is. This radio station is our community. It comes from the community. It is part of the community. And we just, you know, it just, our community is so often filtered through the work here. The community guides us and we give it back. So it's always nice to read all of the names of the people that support the work that we do. I do want to mention that this edition of The Real Issue is also made possible by the generous contributions, you, KZFR supporters, and by Tender Loving Cafe, featuring artisan pizza, salads, fresh roasted, Tender Loving coffee, craft beers, wine, and more. Tender Loving Cafe is located at 365 East 6th Street, around the corner from the Pageant Theater, and they have a vegan brunch on Sunday mornings with live music and a rotating art gallery. You can find Tender Loving Cafe on Facebook for details. I was just there last night. It's a great place to go before you head to the Pageant Theater. So tonight on The Real Issue, we will get a preliminary report on the point-in-time count that took place last month. The full report has not been released yet, but we will get a sneak preview of the numbers from the point person of that nationwide homeless count. We'll follow up with the president of the board of directors at Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter about their effort to establish a year-round low-barrier shelter. And then we'll finish this edition of The Real Issue with a discussion about an event scheduled for this coming Sunday at the Women's Club on April 14th from 3 until 6 p.m. Nevada City-based Golden Road Productions with the Alliance for Resilience Communities present a roundtable discussion called Redesign Paradise. We'll talk with Michael DiMartino, one of the event organizers, about this gathering, which is being billed as a, quote, roundtable for building bridges between issues and solutions. So to begin, on February 27th, the coordinator for the Butte Countywide Homeless Continuum of Care, Jennifer Griggs, talked about the point-in-time count here. On The Real Issue, she talked to us about the point-in-time count happens every 2 years to count each and every individual who is sleeping in areas not meant for human habitation. That can include parks and cars, as well as staying in temporary shelters, or those who may be couch surfing or are without a permanent home. The count is mandated by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and conducted by local government agencies all across this country. Jennifer Griggs explained that because of the campfire, HUD allowed Butte County to postpone the count, and she predicted the level of homelessness would rise as compared to the same number 2 years ago. Just 2 weeks ago, on March 28th, the point-in-time count took place here in Butte County, and Jennifer Griggs is back in the studio to share some of the preliminary findings, although the report has not yet been released to the public. So we are getting the first round of numbers. It is quite special here on The Real Issue. Once again, Jennifer Griggs is the coordinator for the Butte Countywide Homeless Continuum of Care. Jennifer Griggs, thanks so much for being back again.
Thanks, Sue, for having me.
It's as a fellow data geek, it is so exciting to have you here in the studio to talk about the numbers.
I'm so excited to be here. This being my first point in time count, I had the data from the prior years, 2017, 15, 13, and 11, and I reviewed them from just a baseline perspective in October, November. But I hadn't looked at them since then. And today, as I was getting my reports ready, I looked at them because part of what we do is compare what's happening this year to what's happening in the past. And although I cannot give you specific numbers because those still have to be approved by our COC council, which is going on Monday. I can tell you that I was sadly disappointed the number was greater than zero, because our goal is to have zero as our number for homelessness. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I just want to remind everybody of. It's not necessarily a good thing to ever have an increase in numbers. Mm-hmm. And so when these numbers come out, we need to understand the methodology. We need to understand what was happening. And we have to really look at the numbers as a percentage, as a individual number, but we also have to look at it in the context of what was going on. And so not only am I fascinated with the actual numbers and counts that we're looking at, and this preliminary report will be speaking about only the unsheltered numbers. We have to divide both of our numbers to our reports to HUD by unsheltered and sheltered. And so the sheltered numbers need to be compared to our HMIS system, or the Homeless Management Information System. So we need to make sure those are all in line before we report on anything. So the report on Monday that will be hopefully approved by the council and coming out is strictly the unsheltered numbers. So these are people living in places that are not meant for human habitation. These are people living on the streets. These are people living in the cars. They're the ones who we most likely see on a day-to-day basis. So the number we're going to be seeing is not the couch surfers. It's not the staying in the hotels. It's not any of those folks, because those are considered sheltered. So I want to just kind of make that clear when the number comes out and people go, wait a second, we had this 1900 number in 2017, that was a combination of not only those who are counted as sheltered, counted as unsheltered, counted as couch surfers in jails and in like rehab facilities. And so it's just, it's real important that I know everybody grasps on numbers, but you know, I'm kind of giving that heads up on that.
That it's more complicated than just a raw number.
Yes, it is extremely more complicated. But I'm more fascinated by the questions we asked.
Oh,
and
great.
That is what I was diving into today. And it's so fascinating for me, because what I thought were the most interesting questions that we hadn't asked before is, what type of housing would you take? Mm. And so we gave all the respondents the ability to say, to answer on multiple. So they could say a small house, tiny house. They could say an authorized encampment, a designated safe parking, dorm style housing, large shelter with pets, large shelter without pets. Mm-hmm. And so we had everything from people giving a single answer to them saying, I would take it all of them. Mm-hmm. And those numbers I thought were fascinating. And so
What did you find?
I found that it is not what our public thinks.
Okay, so let me jump in here really quickly and sort of build the suspense for 1 second. Just as a reminder, what happened on March 28th was a giant group of volunteers spread throughout Butte County and actually connected with people that are unsheltered and asked a list of questions to gather data. And one of the questions that was not on the count 2 years ago, Jennifer Griggs is bringing up, is a question to say, what kind of housing would you be willing to take? Jennifer Griggs, what was so fascinating about the answers that you got?
It was really fascinating that people would take, how do I want to say this, multiple choices, but there were also over over, I think it was like 150 respondents that picked one specifically, that they didn't say they would take more than one. They had a firm idea of what type of housing they wanted. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And when we look at that, we try to see, okay, is there some data error there? So maybe we'll take out the highs and the lows on the counts, and then, or is the percentage wise, you know, the whole thing. And so I'm really working on analyzing that, but I'm finding the percentages of if the what people wanted as a singular was also the highest percentage in all the groups. So I can't tell you what that is yet. But I am going to tell you that will be shocking, because I was actually very shocked with the number one that most often was said, yes, I would take this as an option for housing.
And, oh, I'm dying. Okay, so Jennifer, you said what was very significant, or what was so interesting to you, is that people chose one. Now, I'm not clear on why this is so fascinating. Do you mean because of what the number one answer was, or the number one thing that people figured out, or am I just not getting why this is so fascinating?
The number one answer.
Oh, okay.
If they did not choose multiple,
yes,
and they chose just a single, because they could choose any or all of the seven options, if they only chose one, that to me was the most telling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just fascinated by all this data. It just fascinates me. And then the other question that we asked is, if they could choose a singular service for to be provided in the next 12 months, what would that service be? And we gave the options of detox, life coach / case manager, weekly showers, safe medicine storage, safe personal storage, and there was one more. There's one more. We gave them the option of the other, because we didn't want to, and then the no answer.
Right.
And so that one, again, was just, to me, fascinating. Having only been working in the continuum for a little over a year, I've heard all of these things, and so this is my first time to take data after hearing everything for a year. And so I really hope that this data, when it is given out, people look at it as it is a point in time. It is a snapshot. We did not survey everybody who is experiencing homelessness. I can guarantee you we did not. Our numbers are not overstated, because I actually had people call me and say, did you see the area and this and so forth and so on? And so we can only do what we can do on that singular day.
Right.
And so I am confident that it gave us the snapshot that we need, and that will help all of our community service providers have an understanding of what the population who is unsheltered really is looking for. And then that might be able to help funding sources and the rest of the community understand what we're looking for.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. We are talking with Jennifer Griggs, who is not giving all the data that I was hoping to get, because it hasn't been approved, won't be approved until Monday. But we're talking about the point in time count that took place on March 28th. And as she's talking about, it gives a snapshot of our community, and specifically counting people, not only the raw numbers, but also the qualitative data. Mm-hmm. What would you like? What are the obstacles of getting out of this current situation? How long have you been here? Things like that.
Right.
Jennifer Griggs, you mentioned that you're feeling confident that the count will be good. I do remember that was a very rainy day.
Yes.
And I wonder, I walk through children's playground several times a week, and there's always a group of people there that to me seemed like they are precariously housed, which is apparently the appropriate term at this point.
You're doing awesome.
Okay, great. And it, and I always walk by and I sort of, you know, make note. I always feel like it's my responsibility to, you know, sort of not shy away. And on that particular day, people were not there. And I thought, this is probably going to get in the way of the count. How did the rain affect your strategy?
I think the rain affected us in Chico less than it did in Oroville. Oroville, unfortunately, had a thunderstorm starting around noon. So they could not continue to go walk the streets, their parks, things like that. So the Oroville numbers may come out a little bit less than what they anticipated just because of that. But the Chico numbers, when we look at the population that is unhoused, and we compare it to past, and we compare it to the services that folks are providing in the community, the Jesus Center, the Torah Shelter, Safe Space, and you look at all of that data, and you go, okay, this is not out of the realm of possibilities. This is not, you know, we're not going to get it down to 2% or, you know, even 10%, incorrect or less than, you know. But it is a good representation. And HUD and the state and everybody knows we are no different than any other COC in the United States. It's that snapshot. We know it's underestimated, but it is what we have, and it is the best that we can do. You know, unfortunately, one of the things that we did happen is the trains, the train area and the train tracks, they were actually asked to move about a week before the pit.
Mm.
And so that is one a note that we'll be making, that we need to include Union Pacific. You know, I included a lot of other parties, but Union Pacific was not on my radar to say, hey, can you wait until after this to ask people to move along? You know, it is private property. They absolutely have that right to do
right.
that. But we really worked well with the Chico Police Department and the Oroville Police Department. And it was just that one area on the railroad tracks that I do know that we probably had a less count for. The rain the night before, I do think people may have been more hibernating and staying in. So if they did have a place in the park specifically, that they were staying there and not wandering out. You know, that's going to always happen.
Right.
You know, we did it in March. It was a little bit rainy. You know, when we do it in 2021 in January, we don't know what kind of weather we're going to get then. So all we can do is continue to improve our methodology, continue to get the word out to those that are experiencing homelessness that it's important to come and tell us your story. And that's really how I framed it, is we want to hear your story. And that's why those questions, other than just the demographics and the counting of the numbers, are very important to me and to the COC, because it paints a picture and it paints a story of what homelessness looks like in our community.
Jennifer Griggs, I have two last questions for you, and I feel like I need to wrap them into the same question. General, I know you're not going to give us the numbers, but generally, can we expect a rise? I think it's sort of obvious that we're going to see a rise as a result of the campfire, as a result of a loss of tens of thousands of residents in the in the area as a result of the fire. So I think we can expect a rise. So of course, my first question is, have you seen a rise? Can you confirm that? And ultimately, what is this data going to be used for?
So I will give you one number. Here's my number, because I do think it is important, and it's a general number. But we did see a rise, okay? I don't think anybody, that's going to be a shocker to anybody. What I can tell you is, in the unsheltered population, I'm still vetting the data for it, but it appears that we have over 200 people who are campfire survivors that are in our unsheltered population. And so that is a number that I really want to make sure is accurate and the data is good on that. The interesting fact about that is about 50% of them said they would be willing to relocate out of Butte County. And so to me, that, you know, may not be the best thing for our county from an economic standpoint, but them relocating is really going to be important to help their recovery. So I can tell you that information, and because that will be critical to all of our federal and state partners. They want to know the impact of the campfire on homelessness. And to me, that's a very telling when we have that many people who are impacted by the campfire who are on the streets. And that is not in our hotels. That is not couch surfing. That is the unsheltered population on the streets. And so when we look at what are we going to be doing with this data, obviously I have federal reports I have to file. But we're really going to be looking down and breaking down the questions. So if we've got a population of people who are really looking to get into detox, per se, we want to make sure that we're encouraging anytime we have someone that we meet on the street who is experiencing homelessness. We know there's a high, potentially a high percentage of them that want to go into detox. So we want to say, hey, have you thought about this? Are you ready? So as the community and as a providers, we can start talking to those people, even though we don't know who they are. If we know that 50% of them want something, then we can talk to them about that.
Okay, Jennifer Griggs, the numbers are going to be approved on Monday if everything goes as planned. When can you come back here and help us think through the implications of these numbers?
Right now, I do have my next Wednesday open, my evening open. Other than that, it would have to be the first part of May.
Okay, we'll see you next week here.
Okay.
All right, Jennifer Griggs, thank you so much. We will see you here next time, coordinator for the Butte Countywide Homeless Continuum of Care. Thanks for being here, giving us a sneak preview, and we will talk with you next week.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.
Wonderful. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I have Angela McLaughlin from Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter on deck. So we will be right back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR.
We've been spending the last week or maybe 2 weeks now, we've been touring through Florida and southern Louisiana and down south Mississippi and all that stuff where there's a lot of swamps and a lot of alligators. And I've heard about more horror stories about alligators the last 2 weeks than I think my sleep can stand. I'm going to be waking up in the night seeing these things. So I was feeling pretty relieved about coming here to Texas until my husband reminded me just yesterday, said they got killer bees here. So, kind of edgy. It's like David Letterman said the night, they sting you, they kill you. He said, sting you, kill you. It's as simple as that. Sting you, kill you. Hey, I'd rather go by a killer bee than...
goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night. That's where I met my baby on one hot summer night. He was the tender and the order to beer. It's been 40 years and I'm still sitting here. But you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. We'll go on now and kiss you goodbye, but hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night.
And we are back. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. We just heard from Jennifer Griggs, coordinator for the Butte Countywide Homeless Continuum of Care and the lead organizer of the Point in Time Count. She has certainly just agreed. She's committed to come back next week and give us the real numbers. The preliminary numbers suggest that the level of homelessness, or those who are precariously housed, has increased. She even mentioned that 200 people have responded that they are in that situation in a direct, they are unsheltered. They're not on a couch. They're not, in a hotel. They are on the street. They are unhoused as a direct result of the campfire. The loss of tens of thousands of residential structures and the demand for housing in the pre-existing shelter crisis was increased, causing housing prices to rise, making more people vulnerable to homelessness. One organization that has been responding to the shelter crisis, beginning over a decade ago, specifically during the cold winter months here in Chico, is Safe Space Winter Shelter. Safe Space is a volunteer-driven effort that partners with local churches throughout the winter months. The host churches offer their facilities for 1 or 2 weeks per season, allowing Safe Space volunteers to provide shelter for 50 or 60 people every night. Each night, multiple volunteers come together to do intake, shelter setup, meals, and laundry. Safe Space offers a low-barrier shelter. Guests are not required to take a drug or alcohol test to access the shelter, and they do not limit or deny services if a guest is under the influence of alcohol or drugs. The focus instead is on behavior, and everyone is to abide by the code of conduct. Last night, the Chico City Council agreed to review a proposal that would establish a year-round shelter at the corner of West 4th and Orange Streets. This space, proposed to open in mid-June, would be a low-barrier shelter offering protection from the heat of the summer in addition to protection from cold and wet winters. To talk more about the idea and need for a year-round shelter, in the studio tonight is the president of the Board of Directors of Safe Space Winter Shelter, Angela McLaughlin. Angela McLaughlin, thanks for being here. I've never
thanks
been in the
having.
Studio with me, so I appreciate it. And it's really lovely to know that you're doing the work that you do.
Oh, thank you. We're excited about it.
So Safe Space experienced an increased demand for shelter space since the campfire, but you ended Safe Space ended services early this year, a few weeks earlier than last year. What happened?
You know, churches were heavily impacted by the campfire. A lot of them had opened their doors to evacuees in the first place, and once the evacuees started thinning out and finding other places to go, a lot of the churches have actually rented facilities to Paradise Unified.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one case, we had a church that was actually already scheduled that ended up having their facility rented about a week and a half before we were supposed to be there. And so that was canceled on pretty short notice. But the others, you know, it was a combination of facilities actually being used already and to some extent, probably some volunteer fatigue. People had been volunteering and had these spaces open for months by the time we spoke to them. And I think they were just at the end of their resources.
Mm-hmm. So there, you're at a moment, you're at this, you know, almost a perfect storm, this unfortunate perfect storm where you have this huge rise in demand for safe space shelter, for this winter shelter, but there's obviously even less space because of the demand for churches. What did you do?
There wasn't a lot to do. We really scrambled to try to find other churches or spaces that it could accommodate us. But again, just because the community was already so heavily impacted with evacuees, there was nothing available, and it was pretty heartbreaking. Our board, this is the first time that we've had to close early like this. And so it was frustrating and hard to admit that we weren't going to find a place for those last couple of weeks. But that was what happened.
So, Angela McLaughlin, Safe Space Winter Shelter is a what's called a low barrier shelter. And of course, what that means is it's unlike the other shelters, like, you know, the Torres shelter, in that people that simply need to get out of the weather, you know, maybe they're not clean and sober, but they can't stay in that kind of winter weather. And I think that makes a little people don't understand that, don't understand why you would allow that kind of behavior. Talk about the importance of low barrier shelters.
I mean, at the most basic level, the kind of shelter that we've been providing, you know, folks say, well, you're enabling them. And I always say, we are enabling them. We're enabling them to not die of exposure on the streets at night. You know, there's no, once somebody has died on the streets, there's no hope. And so low barrier shelter, like I said, at the very basic level that we've been providing it, our goal is to keep folks alive. The low barrier shelter that we're looking at building into, we hope to be able to have a broader mission and you know, 24/7 rather than them having to leave during the day. We're partnering with the Jesus Center. The Jesus Center will provide some day services. We've spoken to behavioral health. They're going to work with us. We've spoken with Elijah House. They do addiction services. They're interested in working with us. So we're trying to bring in a suite of service providers so that we can move beyond this just basic survival to actually helping people start to find their way out of these situations.
It seems like a more efficient way, because if you have services that can come together and address a whole host of struggles that people may be going through, as opposed to not, you know, allowing them to come out of the weather, out of the elements, I think it's a real inefficient use of services. And then when somebody does die as a result, I think what happens is the community, you know, starts to think about what kind of a community are we that allows this kind of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, speaking to efficiency, yes, it's not only more efficient for service providers to be partnering, but for Safe Space, we've typically taken about 23 volunteers a night to run the shelter. And at 12 weeks, that's a lot of volunteers. I think we had more than 400 volunteers last year. I'm not sure what the exact number was. But we did intake at one location each night, and then we would bus folks over to the church every evening. And so we'd have separate crews at intake and at the church, and then we had a crew that stayed overnight to monitor our guests. And so if we can probably reduce our volunteer need down to maybe a third of that with this changeover. And we'll be able to afford, this grant has made it so we can afford at least a few staff. So we plan to have a shelter manager and start paying some folks for overnight shifts, which are historically hard to cover. There's efficiency in almost every way possible is going to be improved with this.
And you're talking about the $1 million grant through Walmart.
Yes.
For exactly this kind of issue, the rise in homelessness as a result of the campfire.
Yes, and although I keep on having to clarify this, there was actually $2 million that Walmart donated. They donated $1 million that was specifically for campfire victims, and they after seeing what was going on in Chico and that we had had a really pretty intense previous need and that campfire survivors were going to put more pressure on the system, they specifically allocated $1 million for low barrier shelter. So I think there's been some misconceptions about whether or not this money was designated for campfire survivors, and that was never the case.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Real Issue on KZFR Radio. I have Angela McLaughlin, who is the president of the Board of Directors of Safe Space Winter Shelter, here in the studio with me. Angela, the mayor, Randall Stone, City of Chico Mayor Randall Stone, is the treasurer for Safe Space. So you certainly have political support for opening a year-long 24/7 shelter. Talk about the proposal that is in the process of being discussed. And as you mentioned before we went on the air, a lot of people in public comment got up to make comments about it. What's in the proposal? It's on the corner of West 4th and Orange.
Yeah, so it's the former Woof and Poof building. It was a manufacturing building. It's 15,000 to 17,000 square feet. It's two floors. It's just really ideal for us. We had searched for a while for a building. I mean, not only are we short non-commercial spaces, but commercial spaces really got used up by folks that were trying to restart their businesses after the campfire, as well as municipal folks and Paradise Unified. So there were very few spaces available. The grant, between the grant and we also received some HEAP funds, we basically have enough money for about an 18-month 24/7 shelter. Some of the other buildings that we looked at had, $200,000 plus worth of requirements to make them habitable at all. So this one has been well maintained. It's ready to go with minimal investment on our part. So there was a lot of that fed into the location. In addition, there's been folks hanging out at Depot Park and in the streets down there and downtown. So it seemed like an ideal location for us. They're already there. This gives us an opportunity to get them indoors, start to do some case management. The folks won't be allowed to leave the shelter after they've checked in for the evening. So we're hoping that eliminates some of nighttime concerns.
How big is it? I read it was a giant building.
It is a giant building. It's over 15,000 square feet. And we anticipate we could probably house 200, but really we're anticipating 100 right now. We'll probably start lower than that if we start during the summer. We'll start with a smaller number, and it'll give us a chance to work out the bugs and just kind of create the culture that we want to see there.
Is there a model? Because as I listen to this, I'm thinking, holy cow, this is so unwieldy. And how do you talk with people that say, this is such a bad idea, you're only going to encourage bad behavior and it's going to become a dangerous place? How is there a model that you all are using to say, look, this has been done in other places, or we have a good idea and we're going to give it a go?
No, there absolutely is a model for this. Housing First is federal, state, and county county requirements. And so Housing First kind of has three pillars, and the two primary pillars are rapid rehousing. So folks that are easy to rehouse, that have minimal, maybe they really didn't have money for First and security, those kinds of things. That's a primary focus. And a secondary focus is supportive housing, permanent supportive housing. So folks that have serious mental health issues, addiction issues, the idea is to get them into a place where they can just start to stabilize. When you're at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, you're not thinking about anything but getting through the day. And so if we can get them into a place, and there's just tons of research that supports this, if you can get them into a place that's stable, that's secure, that they're not in fear every night about where they're going to go and what they're going to do, they're much more likely to engage with services, and we have service providers there. Low barrier shelter fits into this in that it brings in folks that are not traditionally engaging with the system.
Mm-hmm.
The addicts that are not going to be allowed into traditional shelters can come as they are. It's completely behavior based. It's based on conduct and safety. I mean, that's been a hallmark of Safe Space all the way through. It's safety of our clients, safety of our staff and volunteers, and safety of the surrounding neighborhood. And really, that safety dictates what we require as far as our code of conduct and behaviors. And so, yeah, if you get folks in there, there's just a tremendous body of research that supports that once they start to become more stable, that they're just more able to avail themselves of these services.
Angela McLaughlin, you said that you would come back in a few weeks after the city council has talked about this a little bit further, but I do have one more quick question for you. And you made a comment earlier about establishing a culture. What does that mean exactly? What does that culture look like in terms of, you know, you're letting anybody in, whether they're, you know, clean and sober or not?
So, I mean, the absolute primary, most base part of this is safety, as I already spoke to. But also respect for each other, respect for staff, respect for volunteers, respect for our neighborhood, respect for our facility. That's critical. And we also want to build a culture of the folks that work with us that we're all on the same page. You know, a lot of the times we found at Safe Space, not just a lot of the times, 99.9% of the time, we've hardly ever had to have somebody leave over the years. Most of the time, de-escalation and paying attention to what's really happening with someone resolves the issue. And that's important for us to establish that culture with our staff and volunteers, and for them to understand those techniques.
Angela McLaughlin, president of the board of directors of Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter. You're going to be back here in 3 weeks. Is that right?
I think so. Yep.
Okay. All right. We'll be here. I'll meet you back here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We all appreciate the work you're doing. All right. We're going to take one more quick break. And when we come back, I will have Michael DiMartino on the phone with me to talk about an upcoming event. It is being called Redesign Paradise. Don't go away. We will be right back. And you are listening to The Real Issue.
Over there is where I bought my first car. It turned over once, but then it never went far. And I can see the sun setting fast. And just like they say, nothing could ever last. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye. But hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to my town. To my town, I can see the sun setting down on my town, on my town. Good night. I buried my mama and I buried my pa. They sleep up the street beside that pretty brick wall. I bring them flowers about every day, but I just gotta cry when I think what they say. If they could see how the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing could ever last. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, 'cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night. Now I sit on the porch and watch the lightning bugs fly, but I can't see too good. I've got tears in my eyes. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I don't want to go. I love you, my town, you'll always live in my soul. But I can see the sun setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Well, go on, I gotta kiss you goodbye, but I hold to my lover, 'cause my heart's about to die. Go on now and say goodbye to my town, to my town. The sun has gone down on my town, on my town. Good night.
We are back. You are listening to The Real Issue on KZFR. Our last segment on this edition of The Real Issue, we turn to an event for this coming Saturday, Sunday at the Chico Women's Club on April 14th from 3 until 6 p.m. Nevada City-based Golden Road Productions, along with the Alliance for Resilient Communities, presents a roundtable discussion called Redesign Paradise. This event will feature keynote speakers, community roundtable with Q&A, live music, and a potluck. Speakers will be there from Lotus Guide Magazine, Paradise Guild, legal representatives for community members in litigation with PG&E, and more. To talk about this event, I have on the phone, I think he is in Nevada City, but I have Michael DiMartino. He is the producer of the event, Redesign Paradise. Michael DiMartino is also the co-producer of International Resilience Film Festival in Nevada City. I am so happy to have you on the phone, Michael.
Great, and thank you for just taking some time and bandwidth to have me on the show. And again, my compliments to KZFR for all the amazing work you do in the region and the community.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for saying that. Are you in Nevada City?
Currently, I am. Yesterday, I was in Mount Shasta and then Sacramento and then out in Chico. So, I have a deep commitment to the area, but right now I'm sitting in downtown beautiful Nevada City watching probably the first visible sunset in months.
I know. Every time chance I could, I would run outside and just bask in it. We've so needed it. So, Michael DiMartino, first, talk about what is the idea behind the Redesign Paradise event? What is it that you're hoping to accomplish on Sunday?
Again, thank you for having me on. So real quick, just for those of you who don't know what resilience is, resilience is basically a way to bring together individuals and organizations and governmental representatives from the community to find innovative solutions to common problems that we all share. So what we're doing, particularly in Chico this Sunday, is we're hosting a roundtable to bring together the various factions of the community from people who lived in Paradise, people who are still living in Paradise, along with some nonprofit organizations, the Paradise Guild, and others that are involved, Deb Lucero from the County Board of Supervisors, to start looking at this idea of redesign. Part of resilience is about how we organize our communities. And I think part of the issue, and we know this through permaculture and many other things, is that a lot of what we've experienced in our country and culture is an old design. It's based on a paradigm that's, you can even go back 100, 150, 200 years ago. So with this event, what we're trying to do is saying, listen, the voice of the people who have been affected in Paradise and their input, and also the ability to have them have their voice heard, is just as significant and as important as the organizations that were affected and the ones that are trying to do the forward-thinking work. That could be soil and water remediation to actually rebuilding structures and all the various elements that go into an amazing project like this. And of course, I don't have to tell any of your listeners how catastrophic that fire was. I'm a concerned neighbor, and the fact that 18,000 homes and businesses were lost and people have been displaced, it really affects all of us, and we've seen a huge influx in the community here.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to bring together all these pieces to start to have not just dialogue, but present innovative ideas of all of the issues that the community of Paradise and really the whole region will be facing over the next couple of years.
Michael DiMartino, I got a PSA, which is, when I read the PSA, I thought, absolutely, let's talk about this on the radio. But the first line in the PSA says, we're at a unique point in history where the implications of climate change, environmental exploitation, natural disasters, mismanagement of natural resources, and consequent human injustice invite us to engage in innovative approaches toward creating regenerative solutions and resilient communities. And my reaction to that is, holy smokes, how is anything going to get accomplished in 3 hours? And I'm curious, you know, what is the, I don't want to say agenda because it sounds too wonky, where this, it sounds like this gathering is going to be such a creative burst of, you know, energy and opportunity and vision. But what is those 3 hours going to look like?
And again, thank you for asking. I do want to say this event is a culmination of 4 years of working in the region as an investigative journalist. And really talking with hundreds of people, culminating in this event. Now, of course, in Paradise, the issues that are facing the community there are very different than what's happening up, like, let's say, in Mount Shasta, who's dealing with water contamination from herbicides and pesticides at the headwaters, and also the whole reality of Crystal Geyser now bottling water and potentially the city of Weed losing its water rights. So this has really been based on 4 years of public forums, of meeting with people and doing investigative journalism, producing videos and podcasts on what's on our Golden Road TV and radio station. So for this event, since we've done this work over the last 4.5 years, we have ferreted out and found a lot of, let's say, little gold nuggets in our community of people that have an incredible eagle's eye perspective of big picture stuff, and also have the practical on the ground, rubber hitting the road, understanding, wisdom, and knowledge to present innovative solutions, even topics like permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
So at this event, and again, this is not just a one-off, I want to let you know we're deeply committed and have been for years in the Chico area. I mean, we even had Allie Metters Knight on the show where she was talking about forest mismanagement and the reality of fire hazard because of the way in our colonial mentality we have engineered our society and culture, where back longer ago that indigenous people had a whole different approach of how to do forest and resource management that was a lot safer and was a lot healthier for people in the community. So at this event, we're going to have several keynote speakers. We're going to have David Zink from the Paradise Guild, who also, of course, they help run the Norton Buffalo Hall, which was a huge economic mm-hmm. driver for the community up there as far as arts and culture and bringing people up to the area. We're going to have Rahasia Poe from Lotus Guide Magazine, who has been extremely committed to independent media for over a decade through Lotus Guide Magazine. But he's going to be talking about where they just got one of the standing buildings in Paradise donated to them to actually deal with what's called human resilience. And that's basically helping people who are really still in the fallout and the trauma of what's happened there. I mean, it's so uncomprehendable still that they're doing a lot of work on the ground. So I've been up to several meetings up there. We are having people come to speak about the toxic cleanup aspect mm-hmm. of redesigned Paradise, which sadly to say, between the asbestos, the arsenic, the burned plastics, the chemical contamination, the munitions that they're finding, and even down to compromised storage containers of mercury, that this is going to be a really long process to make that area safe and habitable again. We also are having other people come in who are permaculturalists, people who work with like tiny house construction and alternative design, because part of it is, okay, in this redesign, how do we redesign to make things housing primarily more fireproof? And even issues like before people can start building, how are construction workers even going to be up there to do the rebuild? So we're bringing a lot of people who have a long track history and record of doing this type of work there, who all want to help the community of Paradise out. Even people from like Sierra Streams talking about water remediation, people who want to work with the soil remediation piece. This is such a huge project and catastrophe that it's going to take everybody's effort, and everybody has valid input and everybody has a role. And the other part I'd like to say is when I attended that waste cleanup meeting, to see 300 or 400 people at the church up there who are all basically doing the work and putting their health on the line to help clean that community up is really, it was deeply moving and incredible. So this idea of resilience roundtable is getting everyone together to innovate and strategize. We can't just be in a situation of one person or one organization dictating their plan. This whole idea of roundtable is that everybody should have a voice. Everyone should have some level of input, and then we let the professionals and the people with the track records help to architect how things could be done in a much healthier, safer, and even more permaculturally correct and less hazardous way.
And that is Redesign Paradise. It's going to take place at the Women's Chico Women's Center on Sunday, April 14th at 3 to 6 p.m. Michael DeMartino, where can people find out more information?
If you have the time or if you're on Facebook, you can go to the Alliance for Resilient Communities on Facebook. And again, besides just this event, there's really a long history of events we've produced. There's information there. You can also go on goldenroadproductions.com where we have posters and information, or our Facebook page, and share it. Or you can just really show up. And again, I really appreciate KZFR giving the community a voice for these important issues. Sometimes, as you know, in corporate media, the voices of people, the voices of the community are not always heard.
The other thing I'd like to add really quickly
uh-huh. is, you know, my co-founder of ARC, Lou Casabianca, has been involved in this resilience movement and the Green Festival for decades. So we're bringing a lot of kind of resilient rock stars to the table. And again, this is just one event that we're doing all throughout this region, which we're committed to, which is the Sacramento River watershed. Siskiyou County, where Mount Shasta is, Shasta County in Redding, Butte County there in Chico, Nevada County, Placer, and Sacramento County, all culminating in our Resilience Film Festival, April 9th.
Give it to me, and then we got to go.
Okay, it's April 19th through 21st. That's in Nevada City, where it's 3 days of roundtables, 3 days, 9 venues, 18 films, 15 performers, 30 keynote speakers, 12 hands-on workshops, 20 nonprofits, 2 forums, and this event will be live-streamed on radio and TV and also be being broadcast. So this is a whole weekend of people coming together to share ideas and innovation and identify the resources to help make our communities healthier and happier. We're not trying to politicize anything. We're not against anything. All we're trying to do is build bridges between community issues and collaborative solutions between people, nonprofits, and local government.
You are an inspiration. We will see you on Sunday at the Chico's Women's Club from 3 to 6 p.m. Michael DeMartino, thank you so much.
And thank you, Pam Leary, for connecting the dots with us.
That's right. Thank you. We'll see you on Sunday. All right. This brings us to the end of this edition of The Real Issue, which is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by BCAC.TV, Butte County's public access television station, broadcasting on Comcast Channel 11. BCAC.TV provides award-winning, locally produced arts, entertainment, and information programming, including daily broadcasts of Democracy Now! Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Things are changing at Comcast Channel 11. For more information or to get involved, visit